All right, listen, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Job. I believe we left off in chapter 16 and chapter 15. It was Eliphaz the Temanite was the one who once again began to just basically reiterate what's already been said. I mean, you know, I'm trying to go through this book at kind of a quick pace simply because when we're going through all this dialogue, I mean, there's a lot of it that is repetitious. There's a lot of it that's kind of monotonous. It's, you know, it's redundant. In other words, history friends, they don't really say anything new. They just rephrase what they're saying. And what they're basically saying just over and over and over again is, look, Job, there must be some horrendous sin in your life because there's no other explanation as to why you would be suffering the way that you are. I mean, this is where they were coming from, and they just kept piling on Job. And Job was, you know, he's just down and out, and these guys, instead of getting down where he's at and putting their arm around him and weeping with him and just praying with him or just doing everything they could to console him, I mean, they turned on him. When they first arrived on the scene, they were appalled by what they saw, and they didn't say anything for 7 days. For a whole week, they just sat with him. I think that was their greatest wisdom. But now they've turned on him. And, you know, I've seen this happen, and it's happening today, and I see it happening primarily in this group. You know, this health, wealth, and prosperity crowd that runs around, they have this theology, this mindset that basically says, name it and claim it. If you believe strong enough that you have deep enough faith, then anything's possible, that you should have be wealthy, you should be healthy, you should be prosperous, that you should be blessed in every way. And that kind of theology is really heresy. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And then the other side of that coin is the health, wealth, and prosperity crowd basically are suggesting or implying that, look, if things are really miserable in your life, if your health is in the toilet and your finances are in bankruptcy and all these other things, it's because you got sin in your life or you don't have enough faith in your life or this type of thing. Well, these friends of Job are attacking him on that perspective. I mean, they're not coming out and saying what he did. In other words, Job is basically saying, hey, you know, what have I done wrong? Prove it to me. You know, show me what I've done wrong. But they must be in the back of their mind thinking, well, Job, what a phony this guy has been all these years. I mean, he's got to be some kind of serial adulterer or some kind of mass murderer or some kind of pedophile or some kind of, you know, lying, cheating, swindling, good-for-nothing that has really oppressed the poor. He's done something in his life, and he's not coming clean. So you see the situation. Now Job responds to Eliphaz in this chapter 16 when it says, then Job answered. He says, I've heard many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Is there no limit to your windy words, or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain. In other words, he's saying, hey man, you know, everything you're saying, you know, I've heard all this before. And it's simply because, you know, people say something or believe something, that doesn't necessarily mean it's true. I mean, I remember Adolf Hitler used to say, hey, if you tell a big enough lie often enough and long enough, then people are going to believe it. Look at the lies that are being repeated over and over and over and over again, and enough people are falling for it, hook, line, and sinker. And that's what Joe Bakes basically is saying to his three friends. He's saying, hey, I've heard all this stuff before. That doesn't mean it's true, all right? Because he says there's no limit to your windy words. But then he says this, if you were in my position and I was in your position, hey, he says, I could do the same thing. I could act in this condescending manner. I could string words together. I could bring all kinds of phrases or accusations against you. And I could attack you verbally the way you are to me. But basically he said there that instead, if the situation were reversed and they were the ones that were suffering, he said he would, you know, do everything he could in his power to comfort them, to put his arm around them and to strengthen them. And I mean, sometimes when people are suffering, that's all you can do. It's just say, hey, man, I'm here for you. Put your arm around them and say, I don't understand why God has allowed this to happen in your life. I don't know how many times I've gone through that, down that road with people who are suffering, you know, not knowing why God has allowed certain things to happen to them, certain things that have transpired in their life. I mean, I don't know how many funerals I've been to. Look at Janet. We just buried her, 7 months ago, and we prayed and prayed and prayed for her healing, and just to see that poor girl just deteriorate the way she did and then die. It's like, I have no explanation, but can you imagine somebody going up to her and saying, well, you're dying because there's some secret sin in your life? Wouldn't that be throwing salt into a person's wounds? Wouldn't that be extremely insensitive?
What I had a hard time with about hers was that she had more faith than anyone I've ever known, mm-hmm. that God was going to heal her. And she clung to his promises.
Yeah.
And she still died.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah, well, see, we don't have explanation for that, do we? But all we could do is just be there for her, you know, pray with her, put our arm around her, comfort her.
Do you think
her.
When we get to heaven, if we make it, he'll tell us why?
Oh, sure, you'll know why. It'll be so abundantly clear. Just like when reading this, Job's going through this, has no clue, no idea what's happened. And as a matter of fact, when we get to the end of the book, you know, when it really picks up and really gets good, when God gets into the picture, God never explains anything to Job. Instead, God fires about 90 to 100 questions at Job, just one after another. Boom, 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 boom. And Job doesn't have an answer for anything. You know, and God doesn't explain a thing to him. So I'm sure that he went to his grave not even knowing what happened behind the scenes. But he knows now. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Same thing with, you know, Janet and the rest of them. But anyway, I'm just simply saying that Job said, hey, if the situation was reversed, I would be down there comforting you with words. You know, then it says in that verse 5, it says, I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain. If I speak, my pain is not lessened, and if I hold back, what has left me? In other words, what he's saying, whether he complains to his friends about what's happening to him, or whether he just, you know, tries to bear this in silence, or just grin and bear it, whatever he does, whether he talks about it or he doesn't talk about it, he doesn't find any relief one way or the other. He doesn't find any kind of comfort and any kind of solace, whether he speaks about his pain or his suffering, or, you know, keeps quiet about it. And he says in verse 7, he says, but now he has exhausted me. Now he's talking about God. He's saying, he has exhausted me. Thou hast laid waste all my company. In other words, you know, he's lost all of his children, but not only that, his wife turned on him, his brothers have turned on him, his sisters have turned on him, his family, his friends, his servants, everybody has turned on him. He's lost all of his company. He says in verse 8, and thou hast shriveled me up, and it has become a witness, and my leanness rises up against me, it testifies to my face. In other words, he's emaciated. He looks like a person who's dying of cancer. You know, he's lost all his weight. He's probably just skin and bones. He's covered with sores. He looks like death warmed over, and even his appearance, it just depresses him. And it becomes important to other people, and other people will look at him and they'll feel like, well, he's obviously being stricken by God for his wickedness. And then in verse 9, he says, his anger, in other words, God's anger has torn me and hunted me down. He has dashed at me and with his teeth, and my adversaries glare at me. They have gaped at me with their mouth, and they have slapped me on the cheek with contempt. They have masked themselves against me. God hands me over to ruffians and tosses me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he shattered me, and he has grasped me by the neck and has shaken me to pieces. He has also set me up as his target. His arrows surround me. Without mercy, he splits my kidneys open. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks through me with breach after breach. He runs at me like a warrior. I have sewn sackcloth over my skin and thrust my horn in the dust. In other words, my power, my hope has gone into the dust. My face is flushed from weeping, and deep darkness is on my eyelids. Although there is no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure, O earth, do not cover my blood, and let there be no resting place for my cry. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high. My friends are my scoffers, and my eye weeps to God. Oh, that man might plead with God as a man with his neighbor. For when a man's years are past, I shall go the way of no return. Now, you know, he kind of gives us a little bit of insights here as to what's happened to him. Now, like I said, he's in a garbage dump. He's standing at death's door. He's completely emaciated. He's covered with all kinds of sores. And people passing by are spitting at him. They're making fun of him. He says that God's turned him over to ruffians. You know, people are just making sport of him. Can you put yourself in this guy's shoes? I mean, you know the devil's throwing everything at this guy, including the kitchen sink, and he's trying to break him, trying to get him to just curse God and just die. But he's not cursing God, but he's complaining to God, like, you know, why is this happening to me? Why? I just don't get it. But you get kind of glimpses of everything that's being piled on the poor man. The devil just has pulled out all stops. He's just hell-bent on just breaking Job. And you can see it. But look what happens. When Job gets down to one of his lowest points, all of a sudden, at that lowest point, he grabs hold of some hope. And he grabs hold of, you know, his faith almost begins to rejuvenate. Because look what he says there. And I think it's really, really something, what he says here. He says in verse 18, O earth, do not cover my blood, and let there be no resting place for my cry. Interesting. Remember when Cain slew his brother Abel? God said, hey, the blood of your brother Abel is crying out to me from the ground. In other words, it was his life's blood on the ground. It was crying out to God for justice as what his brother had done to him. And Job is saying this, O earth, do not cover my blood, and let there be no resting place for my cry. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high. Now look at, he gets to the point of almost total despair, and then he clings on to the hope, knowing that there's got to be a witness in heaven. I know it. I just know it in my bones, in my gut. I just know that I'm going to be vindicated here. That he basically is saying, I know that my Redeemer lives, my Advocate lives. And it's really Jesus Christ. He just knew it in his heart. He knew it by faith that God is just too good to be unkind. He's too wise to make mistakes. He's not going to be unjust. And he just knew it. Even though everything in his circumstances dictated otherwise, he clung to that. And he says in verse 20, my friends are my scoffers. My eye weeps to God. Oh, that man might plead with God as a man pleads with his neighbor. In other words, he just longed to be able to just talk to God, face to face, man to man, and just discuss this. What's the problem? What have I done wrong? And then in verse 22 says, for when a few days are past, I shall go the way of no return. In other words, he's basically saying, I just want an opportunity to talk to God about this before I die. And then it's chapter 17, continues on with this discourse when it says in verse 1, it says, my spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me. In other words, what he's saying, he feels like, okay, I'm ready to die. I'm at death's door. I'm at the very threshold of the grave. You see people, then they have that look of death all over them, and that's basically what he's saying. My spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes over their provocations. In other words, his friends became his mockers. And he's looking at what they have said. He's just looking at what they've been saying to him, and it's just like he can't believe it, that everything they're accusing him of, at the state that he's in, he just feels like, hey man, this is way out of line, and you guys are way out of line. It just doesn't make any sense. And then he says, verse 3, he says, lay down now a pledge for me with thyself. Who is there that will be my guarantor? For thou hast kept their heart from understanding, therefore thou wilt not exalt them. He who informs against friends for a share of the spoil, the eyes of his children also shall languish. But he has made me a byword of the people, and I am one at whom they spit. My eye has grown dim because of grief, and all my members are as a shadow. So the upright shall be appalled at this, and the innocent shall stir himself against the godless. Nevertheless, the righteous shall hold to his way, and he who has clean hands shall grow stronger and stronger. So, you see what I'm saying? The guy is fluctuating between despair and hope, despair and hope. Every time he gets down to that low ebb, and he just feels like there's just no more hope for me. And then he rallies back, and he feels like, okay, you know, I still believe, I still believe, I still believe. I mean, have you ever been there? Have you been to that point where you can just get to the point where you just feel so beaten down, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, whatever, and just feel like, well, it seems so hopeless, but you just cling to this realization, hey, man, I know that God's going to see this through for me, even in the times of hopelessness. That's what he's saying here when he says in verse 9, nevertheless, the righteous shall hold to his way, and he who has clean hands shall grow stronger and stronger. But come again, all of you now, for I do not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying, the light is near, and in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you are my father, to the warm, you are my mother and my sister. Where now is my hope? And who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol or to the grave? He says, shall we together go down into the dust? And in other words, what I'm saying is, you see how he's fluctuating back and forth? I've been there many times, feeling like, you know, get to the point where you're at the very brink of despair or discouragement or whatever. And then you just rally back. You just feel like, no, I'm going to keep going. No, I'm going to keep trusting. I'm going to keep hanging on and keep believing. And then the devil knocks you down again, you know, and you just kind of keep getting back up. Well, this is what this guy is doing. He says in that verse 13 and 14, he's talking very poetic language here, but he says, if I call to the pit, in other words, to the grave, you are my father. In other words, he just feels like I am so close to death. Because, like I said, his physical appearance must have just looked abhorrent. He just had to look like death warmed over, and he just felt like, I don't have but a few hours, a few days to live, and that's going to be the end of it. But he continues to just hold on tenaciously to this earnest desire to be able to have things set right. Because look what he says here. Okay, never mind. Okay, let's just pick up with this chapter 18 because I think I'm getting ahead of myself from too much reading myself. So, okay, beginning with the chapter 18, it says, "Then Bildad the Shuhite responded, 'How long will you hunt for words? Show understanding and then we will talk. Well, then we can talk. Why are we regarded as beasts, as stupid in your eyes? O you who tear yourself in your anger, for your sake is the earth to be abandoned or the rock to be moved from his place?'" You know, it's kind of hard to read because he's doing it in this poetic language, but I think what he's saying here is he's saying, you're tearing your robes in your anger, or your anger is going to make the earth quake, and it's going to make everything, everybody terrified and really afraid of what you're saying. You know, that's what he's basically saying to Job. And he says in verse 5, it says, "Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out, and the flame of his fire gives no light. The light in his tent is darkened, and the lamp goes out above him. His vigorous stride is shortened, and his own scheme brings him down. For he is thrown into the net by his own feet, and he steps on the webbing. A snare seizes him by the heel, and a trap snaps shut on him. A noose for him is hid in the ground, and a trap for him on the path. All around terrors frighten him and harry him at every step. His strength is famished, and calamity is ready at his side. His skin is devoured by disease. The firstborn of death devours his limbs. He is torn from the security of his tent, and they march him before the king of terrors." The king of terrors would be death. "There dwells in his tent nothing of his. Brimstone is scattered on his habitation. His roots are dried below, and his branches cut off above. Memory of him perishes from the earth, and he has no name abroad. He is driven from light into darkness and chased from the inhabited world. He has no offspring or posterity among his people, nor any survivor where he sojourned. Those in the west are appalled at his fate, and those in the east are seized with horror. Surely such are the dwelling of the wicked, and this is the place of him who does not know God." Now, you know, this is Bildad. He chimes in now. He jumps in, and look what he's saying. He's saying the same thing. I mean, isn't it kind of monotonous? It's kind of redundant. It's kind of just over and over and over. They're saying things repetitiously, but they're saying them in different ways. And but the bottom line of what he's saying is this, basically, is, hey, the wicked are always punished. The wicked are always get theirs. The wicked's prosperity, it's only short-lived. They may seem or they may appear to prosper, but their end is certain as far as their destruction. I mean, they're going to go not just down to the grave in disgrace, but he's talking about here, he's talking about a trap and a noose and all kinds of webbing and snares that are going to be, you know, all of a sudden take hold of the wicked and they're going to bring him down. Well, that's not true. It's not true at all. But this is their argument, is that, hey, Job, look at your situation. You are being punished because you're wicked, because you're a sinful, wretched, good-for-nothing man, and you better come clean if you have any hope whatsoever of getting right with God and having your fortunes restored. That's basically what they're saying to him. So let's read this chapter 19, because Job's response, I think, is pretty insightful. But he says this in that verse 1. "Then Job responded, 'How long will you torment me and crush me with words? These 10 times you have insulted me, and you are not ashamed to wrong me. Even if I have truly erred, my error lodges with me.'" You know what he's saying there? He's basically saying this. Okay, they keep insulting him. They keep accusing him. And he's saying this. He's saying, hey, listen, even if I've sinned, he says, even if I've erred, even if I've sinned, I'm the only one that would know it. That's basically what he's saying. Read it again. Starting with verse 3, "These 10 times you have insulted me, you are not ashamed to wrong me, even if I were truly erred." In other words, even if I really have sinned, he says, my error lodges with me. In other words, I and I alone would know it. But you guys, you're just assuming. You're just making up things. You know, you're just accusing me of things that have no validity whatsoever. He's just kind of really getting exasperated, because if he has sinned, they need to be specific about it. They're just speaking in generality, saying, well, the wicked man, this always happens to the wicked man, Job, and it never happens to the righteous man. Well, look what Job says in that verse 5. He says, "If indeed you vaunt yourselves against me and prove my disgrace to me, know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me." When he says, "If indeed you vaunt yourself against me," in other words, you assert yourself over me and prove my disgrace to me. He's basically saying, that God is dealing with me, and you guys are just piling on here. Because he said in verse 7, he says, "Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my ways so that I cannot pass. He has put darkness on my path. He has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And he has uprooted my hope like a tree. He has also kindled his anger against me and considered me as his enemy. His troops come together, and they build up their wall against me and camp around my tent. He has removed my brother far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my intimate friends have forgotten me. Those who live in my house and my maids consider me a stranger, and I'm a foreigner in their midst. I call to my servant, but he does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am loathsome to my own brothers." He says, "Even young children despise me. I rise up, and they speak against me. All of my associates abhor me. And those I love have turned against me. My bone clings to my skin and my flesh, and I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth. Pity me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does? Are you not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were written, and oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that with an iron stylus and lead they were engraved in a rock forever. And as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth, even after my skin is flayed or destroyed. Yet without my flesh," in other words, from my flesh, "I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, 'How shall we persecute him, and what pretexts of for a case against him can we find?' then be afraid, for the sword for yourselves, for the wrath brings punishment from the sword, so that you may know there is judgment." Okay, now, you know, the reason I read this all the way through is because now you begin to see, I think, Job, he gives us more insight as what's happening to him as far as his torment, okay? Look at some of the things that he says here. He, first of all, he just feels like God is just absolutely attacking him. You know, he says that, like in verse 8, "He has walled up my way so I cannot pass. He has put darkness on my path. He has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side. I am gone. He has uprooted my hope like a tree. He has also kindled his anger against me and considered me his enemy. His troops come together and build up their way against me. They kept him around." In other words, he's going on and on and on of all these different examples, analogies, and metaphors of which he feels like God is just really beating him down. And yet, he gets down to that low point, and what does he say at the very end of this? He says, "Yet I know my Redeemer lives, and I will see him in my flesh." I'll get to that in just a second here, but he's also saying that all his relatives have forsaken him. Put yourself in this guy's shoes. How could any human being have endured the way this man has? Because he says his relatives have failed, his intimate friends have forgotten me, you know, they've forsaken him in the midst of all of his pain. He says those in my house and my maids consider me a stranger. In other words, he lost his children, he lost all of his wealth. Apparently he still had a house or a tent, but he got basically run out of there. I mean, his wife just felt like, "You're just cursed, get out of here." And he couldn't even bribe his servants for, you know, a glass of water. He says that verse 16, "I call to my servant, but he does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am loathsome to my brothers." In other words, his whole appearance, his wife wants nothing to do with him. I mean, you know, he's got halitosis. I mean, the poor guy is just beaten up. And he says in verse 18, "Even young children despise me." He once was a man that was greatly honored and revered and esteemed, and now he's insulted by kids, by ruffians, by good-for-nothings. He says, "They rise up and they speak against me. My associates his friends abhor him, and those who have loved turn against me." I mean, he's got no one. I mean, put yourself in this poor guy's shoes. And he says, "My bone clings to my skin and my flesh, and I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth." You know, you ever hear that expression, "by the skin of your teeth"? Well, it comes out of the Bible. There's so many things going on in the Bible people don't know that we have expressions today for. But that's what Job says, that he just, by all rights, he should be dead. And he's just escaped death by a centimeter. And he just feels like, well, I'm going to die any minute now or any day now. And then he says to his friends, pity me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does?" He says, "and are not satisfied with my flesh." In other words, he's looking at his friends saying, "Hey, man, you know, take compassion on me. Have pity on me. I mean, look at me. Take a look at me. Look at my life. Put yourself in my shoes. Don't just be plowing on me. I mean, I think this is pretty darn instructive, because I think sometimes we can make that mistake, because the Bible does say man judges by outward appearances, but God judges the heart. And sometimes, you know, in situations where we see people that are suffering greatly, the last thing we need to do is to act as their judge, jury, and executioner. What we really need to do is act as their advocate, pray for them, get down with them, take their hand and strengthen them, encourage them, do what you can to just uplift them. When I read this the first time, I just thought to myself, this is exactly what has happened. Because look at that, verse 23. When he says in total exasperation, he says, "Oh, that my words were written, oh, that they were inscribed in the book, that with an iron stylus or a pen and lead, that they were engraved in the rock forever." You know, look what he just said there. And this is what he just wishes would happen. Now, isn't this what happened? Isn't this what happened? I mean, if these are God's words, then these words are eternal. They have been inscribed forever. Look what he just said here. "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that with an iron stylus and lead, that they were engraved in a rock forever." And that's exactly what happened. You know, because I remember reading that, and I just thought, oh, they are. They're written there. I mean, here we are reading this thousands of years after the fact, and this will be preserved forever. And that's what he wanted so desperately, to have his side of the story told. And he says in that verse 25, "And as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives." Again, look at the fluctuation he's going through. He gets down to despair, and then he just kind of, it's almost like a guy who's just been in a boxing ring, has just been knocked down one time after another, and just when you think he's down and out, and he says no more breath in him, he gets back up on his feet, because this is what he says, "As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives." And he's speaking of Jesus, all right? He says, "As for me, I know my Redeemer lives, and at last he will take his stand on the earth." Isn't that what's going to happen? He says, "Even after my skin is flayed or destroyed, yet," he says, "yet without my flesh," literally what it means is, "yet from my flesh, in my flesh, I shall see God." He's speaking of a time of resurrection here, all right? That's what, I mean, he just knows it. He just believes it. He's certain of it, that even though he's going to die, there's going to come a day when he will be resurrected and see God in his flesh. He says in verse 27, "Whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, 'How shall we persecute him, and what pretext of a case against him can we find?' then be afraid. For the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment." Basically, he's cautioning his friends. He says, you better take heed, all right? Because he's still pleading his innocence, and he's saying, you better watch yourself. Because I know that my Redeemer lives, and I know that I'm going to see him in my flesh, and I know that he's going to justify me, and you better be very, very careful of what you're accusing me of, because, you know, this basically he's saying that the sword cuts both ways, and if you start accusing me of things that are false, then you're going to have to answer to God for it. That's basically what he's saying. Anybody have anything to want to add or share to what we read there? Because I'd like to just press on to a couple more chapters if we can. Because like I said, we could spend months in this book. But because so much of it is repetitious, I think we could just kind of wade through it as quickly as possible. Because like I said, the momentum begins to really pick up after this cycle of discussion goes full circle. In other words, there's three cycles that take place that Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar speak to Job one after another. And Job replies to them one after another, and it happens three different times. All right, and then the third time, it's only Eliphaz and Bildad that continue to accuse Job. And then the fourth time, the third time, instead of Zophar coming in, there's another character that enters the picture is kind of a unique character that has a different light or another light to shine upon what's happening here. But anyway, beginning in that verse 1 in chapter 20, it says, "Then Zophar the Naamanite answered," says, "therefore my disquieting thoughts make me respond, even because of my inward agitation. I listen to the reproof which insults me, and the spirit of my understanding makes me answer, 'Do you know this from old, from the establishment of a man on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the shout of the godless momentary?'" Now, look carefully what he's saying, all right? Because what he's saying is absolutely false, all right? It does have some truth to it. It does sometimes happen, but does it happen all the time? Look what he's saying, all right? That the triumphing of the wicked is short. Is that always the case? You know, man, I see the wicked live on and on and on and on and on. I wonder if you can ever dynamite them out of their position or their, you know, their position of power where they can wield such wickedness and such evil. He says, "And the joy of the God is momentary. Though his loftiness reaches the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he perishes forever like his refuge. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' He flies away like a dream and they cannot find him, even like a vision of the night and he is chased away. The eye which saw him sees him no more, and his face no longer beholds him. His sons favor the poor." What does he mean by his sons favor the poor? Basically, what he's saying here is the wicked man, his sons are going to wish he were poor. He's going to be so poor, he's going to wish he were poor. He's going to favor the poor. You know, I mean, I look at the poor in the United States. The poorest of our poor in this country are much richer than many of the poor in the third world countries, all right? I mean, that's just a fact of life, right? So it's basically saying here that his sons favor the poor. Do you see this happening? I don't see it happening. I don't see it happening on any grand scale, and even in a general sense. I see just the opposite happening. He says here, his sons favor the poor, and his hands give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but he lies down with him in the dust. In other words, he's cut down in his youth. I mean, I don't see that happening. He says, verse 12, though evil is sweet in his mouth, he hides it under his tongue, though he desires it, and will not let it go. But behold, it is in his mouth, that yet his food is in his stomach, and it is changed to the venom of cobras within him. He swallows riches, but will vomit them up. God will expel them out of his belly. I mean, I don't see this happening to a lot of people. Look at people that, for example, are in Hollywood or the entertainment industry. Or look at people in the ACLU. I mean, they lead the charge of the God haters. The ACLU, Hollywood, the entertainers, they lead the charge, don't they? And how many of these people do you see go down in flames? I don't see it. They are fat and sathy and wealthy and healthy, and I just don't see it. And they live on for years and years and years and years and years. You know, sure, there's always exceptions to everything, but as a general rule of thumb, I don't see it. I don't see it at all. I see the wicked are prosper, and they go on and on and on and on. And then he says here in that verse 16, he says, he sucks the poison of cobras, and the viper's tongue slay him. He does not look at the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and curds. In other words, these are symbols of the good life. In other words, it's not going to last long for him. Well, I don't see that. I look at some of these people in Congress, and they've been in there for decades on end. You see them out on their yachts and on their sailboats year after year. They got cabins here. They got residents there. I mean, they travel all over the world. They got money coming out their ears, and they live in ease. They live in luxury. They live in comfort. They live in power. They live in influence, and they just live on and on. I don't see them brought down with all of their sins. I just don't. He says in verse 18, he returns what he has attained, and he cannot swallow it. As to the riches of his trading, he cannot even enjoy them. You know, I don't see that happening at all. I got a magazine over there 2 weeks ago. You see that front cover of the Time magazine where it talked about how these CEOs have just squandered so many of people's investments and so much of the hard work that people have put in all their life long to try to build up a nest egg and retirement for themselves. And the CEOs, through so much lying, cheating, and stealing, and conniving, and finagling, and dishonesty, they have basically walked away with other people's hard-earned money. And they are enjoying it. You know what I'm saying? In verse 19, for he has oppressed and forsaken the poor, and he has seized a house which he has not built. So, I'm not sure, but it almost looks like Zophar is now even getting a little bit more specific. Like, Job, you know, this is what you must have done. In other words, look at that verse 19. For he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. In other words, the wicked. When he says he, for the wicked, has oppressed and forsaken the poor, he has seized a house which he has not built. The suggestion there is that, Job, you must have done something like this, right? And then verse 20 says, because he knew no quiet within him, he does not retain anything he desires. Nothing remains for him to devour. Therefore, his prosperity does not endure. In the fullness of his plenty, he will be cramped, and the hand of everyone who suffers will come against him. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him, and he will rain on him while he is eating. He may flee from the iron weapon, but the bronze bow will pierce him. In other words, he's saying that, you know, the wicked man, he's not going to escape judgment. He's not going to escape punishment. He's not going to escape reaping what he's sown, as far as God is concerned. But I see it all the time. The wicked will go to their grave in old age and at ease and still have all their wealth and everything else. I mean, it happens all the time. So what Zophar is saying here is just absolutely not true. He says in verse 25, it is drawn forth and comes out of his back, even the glittering point from his gall. Terrors come upon him. Complete darkness is held in reserve for his treasures, and an unfanned fire will devour him. It will consume the survivor in his tent, and the heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart, and his possessions will flow away in the day of his anger. This is the wicked man's portion from God, even the heritage decreed to him by God. You see, this is the same thing. He's saying nothing new. He's just reiterating the same old hash. He's rehashing the same old thing. That's all he's doing. Just basically accusing Job of being in this situation where he's the wicked man, and this is why he's suffering. Because why? Because he says, all you have to do is just look around, and you will see that the wicked always get it. I can't help but wonder, where is this guy coming from? Is he living on the moon? Does he really know what's going on? Does he really see what's happening? I've been around, you know, for 58 years, and I have seen my whole life long the righteous suffer and the wicked, you know, prosper. But at the same time, I haven't seen all the righteous suffer all the time or all the wicked prosper all the time. You see what I'm saying? It's like we're in a situation where we don't, you know, we can't really say that this is the way God does things because God's sovereign. Anybody have anyone to add or share? Poor Kevin, he's ready to fall off his chair there. You know, I'll tell you what. We'll just go through this 21, and I'll go through it quickly. You know, it'll be five chapters. It'll be halfway through the book. You know, that way you guys can, you know.
We're not in a race. You are.
Well, you guys are falling off your chair, man. All you guys are going to sleep on me. I think, well, you know what? I mean, put yourself in Job's shoes, you know, and, you know, just bear with it, okay? Okay, verse 21, chapter 21. Then Job answered, listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your way of consolation. Bear with me that I may speak, that then after I have spoken, you may mock. But as for me, is my complaint to man? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished, and put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am disturbed, and horror takes hold of my flesh. Why did the wicked still live and continue on, also because also become very powerful? In other words, what he's saying, he's saying, let me talk for a bit, then you can refute me if you want, you can mock if you want. But he's basically saying, why shouldn't I be impatient? He's saying, I'm not complaining to you guys, you know, I'm complaining to God, all right? That's basically what he's saying, and he's saying here, he's taking a look at himself, and he's saying, man, horror grips him. I mean, he looks at himself in a mirror or, you know, sees his reflection in a pond or something, and he looks at himself and he just, look what he says in that verse 5. He says, look at me and be astonished and put your hand over your mouth. He says, even when I remember, I am disturbed and horror takes hold of my flesh. In other words, take a good look at me and have some pity, have some compassion, be astonished at what you're looking at here. Because he says, when I remember what I look like, you know, the last time I see myself in a reflection, he was just gripped with horror at what he had seen. You know, he is so emaciated and so physically gaunt, and he's just become extremely ugly with all of his sores and his boils and everything. And it's just the poor guy. I mean, just looking at him, people would just feel shocked. They would feel horror. They would feel utter pity. And now he's refuting everything that has been said by Zophar in chapter 20, Job is beginning to refute it. Because look what he says in that verse 7. It says, why did the wicked still live? Continue on, also become very powerful. It says, their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is their rod of God on them. His ox mates without fail. His cow's calf and does not abort. They send forth their little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. They sing to the tremble and the harp, and they rejoice at the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity, and suddenly they go down to Sheol. In other words, you know, they don't die a long, drawn out, ignominious death. you know, they go down basically in peace. It says, and they say to God, depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of thy ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreated him? This to me epitomizes so many people that are in our cultural elite today that are running the show. Verse 16, he says, behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. In other words, I think what he's saying in that verse 16, he says, behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. In other words, their prosperity is not hidden. It's not in their hand. It's plain for all to see. It's plain for all to see their wealth. But Job says here, the counsel of the wicked is far from me. In verse 17, he says, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? Are they as straw before the wind and like chaff which the storm carries away? You say God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. Let God repay him so that he may know it. Let his own eyes see his decay, and let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he care for his household after him when the number of his months is cut off? It says, can anyone teach God knowledge in that he judges those on high? One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied, and his sides are filled out with fat, and the marrow of his bones is moist, while another dies with a bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. Together they lie down in the dust, and the worm covers them. In other words, he's saying, hey, you know, only God knows why, but there's some people, you know, that live on and on and on in the lap of luxury and ease and power and influence, and other people in the world have never tasted a good thing in all their life long, and they still go to the same place, go to the grave. How do you explain that? I mean, this is what we're talking about when we're talking about, you know, how God deals with people. Again, you know, I mean, I don't know how many times I got to keep going back to Isaiah 55. God's thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways aren't our ways. His thoughts and his ways are higher than the heavens are high than our own. And that's basically what Job is saying. And he's saying to his friends, hey, you can't put God in a box. You can't dissect him in a classroom and put him in a test tube and say, this is the way he always acts. But that's what they were doing. They're saying he always punishes the wicked and he always rewards the righteous. And consequently, since you are suffering, then you must be wicked. That's what their conclusion is. And in verse 27 it says, behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me. For you say, where is the house of the nobleman, and where is the tent, the dwelling of the places of the wicked? Have you not asked wayfaring men, and do you not recognize their witness? And wayfaring men, that's somebody who travels around, usually on foot, but he says this, basically he's saying this, ask anybody who's been around a block, ask anybody who's traveled, and they will tell you that this is the case, that many, many times the wicked live on and on and on in ease and prosperity, and many, many times the righteous suffer greatly. And he says anybody should know that. And in verse 30 he says, for the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. They will be led forth at the day of fury. Who will confront him with his actions? And who will repay him for what he has done? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. Look at that. Who does that remind you of? Let me read that. While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb.
Lenin.
Doesn't that remind you of Lenin? Look at Lenin. I mean, Lenin, it was a curse on humanity. He was an absolute curse. He took the writings of Karl Marx, and Karl Marx, if you read his life, he was just one angry man who was just a godless good for nothing, you know, who wrote the Communist Manifesto, and then Lenin took it, read it, and then implemented it, all right? Lenin became a god. Look at Lenin. They had, okay, the Soviet Union has collapsed now, and I don't know what they did with Lenin's body. I hope they threw it in a garbage can, all right? But look what they did. For years and years and years, they had embalmed his body in such a way that millions of people, literally millions of people, went through to see him in his glass coffin, to pay homage to him. He became a god. You know what I'm saying? One of the most wicked men in history. A man whose hands were just dripping with blood. All right? Read this again. He says in verse 31, who will confront him with his actions? Who confronted him? Who confronted Stalin? Who confronted Mao Zedong? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. They had a 24-hour guard over Lenin's tomb. Right? This was written thousands of years before Lenin. All right? So this was nothing new. They had these guards, just, you know, back and forth guarding this guy's tomb. People turned this butcher into a god. Go figure. Who could figure that? That's what basically Job is asking. He says in verse 33, it says the closet of valley will gently cover him. More, in other words, he's going to have a. He's not going to be dumped in some mass grave. He's going to be buried with dignity. He says, moreover, all men will follow after him, while countless ones go before him. You know what it's saying there? I read a book. It was called The Death of Stalin. In that book, it says that Stalin, he's one of the biggest mass murderers in history. But at his funeral, they had this procession, and they had literally millions of people there. And people were being literally crushed to death in this procession because it was just like a wave of humanity. And when a wave would start to go in a certain direction, people would be literally crushed against the walls as people followed this guy's coffin, and people were leading ahead of this guy's coffin. You know, and in that book, it described how they had Soviet soldiers down almost every alleyway with submachine guns mounted on their trucks in case anything were to go wrong. They would just open fire on these people. What I'm saying is, like, look at this guy. One of the biggest mass murderers in history, and look at his funeral. Granted, I bet you a lot of people were there out of fear, but still, a lot of them were out there thinking that this guy was a god. I mean, it was just something else. Same thing with Mao Zedong, same thing with so many of these butchers. Well, that's what he's saying here. He says, moreover, all men will follow after them, and countless ones go before them. How then will you vainly comfort me? Your answers remain full of falsehood. And, you know, that's basically it. I mean, just as a conclusion, look at what has happened here. If you go back, we just read chapter 20, where Zophar said that the wicked perish like dung, and yet in verse 7 in chapter 21, Job says that the wicked live on. In chapter 20, Zophar said that the wicked triumph for a short time, and yet verse 7, Job says that they continue to live. In verse 6 and 7, 6 and 11 of chapter 20, Zophar said they lose their loftiness and youthful vigor, and yet Job says in that verse 7 they become very powerful. In verse 26 of 20, Zophar says that they lose the survivors in their tent, and Job says, hey man, they enjoy their children and their grandchildren. And Zophar said in chapter 20, it says they lose their wealth in their houses, and Job turns around and says they live safely in their houses and their herds increased. And in chapter 20, Zophar said that God's fierce anger is against them, and Job says in chapter 21 that they know nothing of God's rod of judgment. And in chapter 20, Zophar says that they have sons who must beg from the poor. And Job is saying, hey, no, I've seen it where they have happy children. And then Zophar said in that chapter 20, says they will have their riches expelled out of their bellies and cannot enjoy prosperity and ease. And Job said they spend their days in prosperity. And in chapter 20, it says they have their sins revealed. And in chapter 21, Job says they get away with sinful defiance of God. And in chapter 20, Zophar says that they suffer for their own sins. Excuse me. And Job said they don't suffer for their sins. Anyway, it just goes back and forth, this bantering. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like verbal volleyball. But Job is refuting everything that Zophar says, as Bildad says, that Eliphaz has said. Zophar had said in chapter 20 that the wicked are forgotten in death. And Job says, no, they're not forgotten. They're given an honorable burial. I look at, you know, this long discourse, this long dialogue that's going on, and I know, like I said, it's kind of monotonous, it's kind of repetitious, and I'm thinking, well, you know what? This could have really been condensed down into just a couple, four or five chapters instead of going on for almost 30 chapters, just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But I think God put it in there for a reason. Because men have wrestled with these questions almost since the dawn of history, all right? And men have come up with the wrong conclusions so often when it comes to human suffering. And the bottom line is, hey, God's thoughts on our thoughts, His ways on our thoughts, and what is His reasoning? Why does He allow things? Look at Brad here. I mean, you know, he's been in that chair for over 20 years, that wheelchair. And I've prayed for him a great deal, and I've just always wondered, why did God give him such a heavy cross in life? Look at Johnny, when he hasn't been here for some time yet, but look at that poor guy. You know, he was basically strangled by his own umbilical cord when he was born. He's lacking oxygen to the brain, and so the poor guy just walks all crippled up, and his tongue is tied up, and he can't speak well, and you know, it's like, what a cross that is to carry. You know, it's like trying to drive this wretched machine all your life long. Why do some people have to have that kind of burden, that kind of cross? You know what? Bottom line, I don't know why. But it would be absolutely insane, foolish, ridiculous, stupid of me to say, well, it's because they got sin in their life. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I think that's the point that I think is being driven home here over and over and over again, that we can make some gross, flagrant miscalculations by trying to judge from outward appearances. Only God knows why he allows certain things to happen. I especially have a difficult time when I see people suffer, when they're suffering mental problems. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I really wrestle with that because I don't know. Is this person bipolar, manic depressant? Is this person insane? Is this person possessed? Is this, what is the story with this person? I mean, have you been there? Praying for a person, not knowing what is their problem, what's behind it, why is this allowed, what's caused this? We went through this with my sister-in-law. I mean, I just was pulling my hair out trying to figure out, what is the story here with this poor girl? She's just dying in front of us, and you feel like you just, you're watching a person drown, and you're doing everything you can to save them, and they just won't take your hand. And you wonder, what in the world? I have no explanation. I have none. And if I were to speculate on some things, that's all it would be. It's just pure speculation. All I could do is just pray that God would have been merciful. But I see other people, like I said, I've been into mental institutions visiting people or even old folks' home, and I see such deterioration mentally, physically, emotionally, and it's like it depresses me. I wonder, why does this happen, you know? And I have no answer. I have no answer. All I can do is just pray for these people or just take their hand and just try to connect with them and show them God's love where I can, you know? And I think that that's probably why this dialogue has gone on for so long. It's because God doesn't want us to miss the point here, that his thoughts are our thoughts and his ways are our ways. And don't make the mistake of being a person's judge when maybe God is bringing pain and suffering and difficulty into their life in a specific way for a very, very good reason, a very specific purpose. Anybody have anything I want to add or share? Yeah.
These three fellow obviously are best friends, or very good friends with Job. And when you are good friends with someone, you tend to share the same belief and everything, but is it because of the devil blinding their eye?
Right.
Why does Job see so clear and they don't? And it's not only not clear, but complete opposite.
The Job, here's a couple of things, okay? The Bible says, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Job was a man who feared God above every man because he was blameless and righteous. So consequently, because of his fear of God, because of his love of God, he had more insight that was much more, I think, accurate than his friends. Now, I'm not saying his friends were godless by any means. They seemed to be, you know, God-fearing people, all right? But they were very, very shallow in comparison to the depths of Job. And I know that Job's depth in his life came from his wisdom that was derived out of his fear of God. See what I'm saying? And also, in the spirit, I mean, Job was saying here, we read this a couple chapters, three chapters or four chapters back, I think it was last week, we read that Job even said that God has blinded their eyes to what the truth is here. And not only that, obviously the devil was stirring them up, because the devil instigated this. He started this with his suggestion when he appeared to Eliphaz in the shape of a shadow. So what's happening here? Goes back to what Paul tells us in the New Testament. We don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against these spiritual forces of wickedness that are all around us. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
Yeah,